Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
3 years later, another evacuation. Take what you can, hope for the best, and then wait it out with friends or in a shelter. It's all too familiar to hurricane evacuees, no matter the storm's name. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Labor Day. It is Monday, the first day of September. Levees around New Orleans are laboring mightily to hold in the aftermath of Hurricane Gustav. So far, the Army Corps of Engineers says there is no indication of levee failures. The water did overtop the Industrial Canal in West New Orleans, flooding some nearby streets. New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin warned residents to keep away from the city because of the ongoing threat of heavy rains. More than 2 million people evacuated the Gulf coastline, and many of them landed in shelters where they're now being fed by the Southern Baptist Convention. Mike Ebert is conducting the SBC's disaster relief effort.
We have feeding units that are stationed and operational right now at about 9 different evacuation sites around the country. When we spoke to the American Red Cross late last week, they told us we needed to be prepared to make about 600,000 meals a day. Each of our kitchen units rolls in with a semi-trailer full of food, and then in partnership with the American Red Cross and FEMA, the food keeps rolling in and replenishing our sites as we need it.
One of those feeding units, as Ebert called them, is stationed in Louisville, Kentucky, and that's where we reached volunteer Coy Webb.
We have somewhere around between 1,500 and 2,000 evacuees that have been brought from New Orleans into Louisville. The bulk of them have been flown in, and they're currently being housed out at the Kentucky State Fairgrounds here in Louisville at the Expo Center. About half of the Expo Center just literally has a couple of thousand cots lined up. The other half divided out into several things. There's a food line. There's an area where folks can sit around tables and eat. There's an area cordoned off where children can play and where we have some Red Cross workers that are working with children. And then there's several staging areas where they're trying to keep luggage and get it to the right individuals and that type of thing, as well as just checking folks in.
And how many meals are you expecting to provide? Do you have any idea how long you might be supporting this effort?
They've asked us to provide 2,000 meals per meal today. We did a very small lunch, and then we're doing a hot supper, and we're going to do 2,000 meals for each of those. They have asked us to be prepared to at least serve through the weekend, and it could go longer depending on the damage along the coastline in New Orleans and how long people have to be evacuated from their homes.
Is this an effort that will be supported financially by governments, or is this something that the Southern Baptist Convention has planned for and has funding for?
As far as the feeding, we do all that on our own. Southern Baptists provide all the equipment, and we do all the training of volunteers, and Red Cross is providing the food that we're using. And so we have a long-term partnership with them, and we work together in this. Most typically, we do the food preparation for Red Cross, and then they do the serving.
What are you hearing from evacuees about their experience?
Overall, it's been very positive. Most of them are just thankful that that they have a place that is safe and where they have food and shelter, where they have shower capabilities. And for the most part, though they hate to be away from their homes and hate that they're experiencing this again, most of them are pretty positive.
Well, Coy Webb, thank you so much for your time today and best of luck.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your support of everything.
Coy Webb is an organizer with the Southern Baptist Convention, which is feeding hurricane evacuees across the country. Despite Gustav's lashing of one of the country's main oil and gas-producing regions, crude oil futures fell 4% in special electronic trading on the NYMEX today. Prices hit their lowest level in more than 4 months. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports on the surprising optimism in the energy markets.
Hurricanes Katrina and Rita devastated U.S. oil infrastructure in 2005. Barbara Shook with the Energy Intelligence Group says the industry learned its lesson. It spent the past 3 years upgrading its offshore rigs to withstand a storm like Hurricane Gustav.
What we've been hearing is that the offshore facilities have suffered very little damage. They've all been upgraded, plus Gustav is not as strong as those storms were.
Jim Rollier is a senior energy meteorologist at private forecaster Planalytics. He says the market is jumping the gun.
Though I sure hope the production region dodged a bullet, as what many market players have been saying this morning, I think this mindset or feeling may be a bit premature.
ExxonMobil, Royal Dutch Shell, and other energy firms won't know the full extent of the damage until they return to the rigs starting tomorrow. Rollier said Gustav ran through some key energy hubs, including Port Fourchon and the Louisiana Offshore Oil Port, or LOOP.
The LOOP terminal took a direct hit. As we know, the LOOP terminal basically provides an artery for gas flow right up to Chicago.
There's still another hurdle to cross, says energy expert Jorge Piñon with the University of Miami.
The weakest link is the refinery capacity to process crude oil into refined products like gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel, which is really what the markets demand.
Gustav is now making its way through a region that is home to nearly half of the nation's refining capacity. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
If you watch even 20 minutes of TV a week, you can't miss them. Ads for prescription drugs. In 2005, the pharmaceutical industry spent more than $4 billion on direct-to-consumer advertising, so it must be working, right? Not according to a study out today from Harvard Medical School researchers. Janet Babin reports from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
It's difficult to measure the effect advertising has on prescription drug sales because there's nothing to compare it to. Nearly all of us see the ads. So the researchers studied prescriptions in Canada. 95% of French Canadians don't watch U.S. television. Their prescription habits were compared to the English-speaking provinces who do watch U.S. TV. The results would probably surprise the pharmaceutical industry. Harvard Medical School professor Stephen Sumire co-authored the report.
There wasn't an ounce of effect for a drug for arthritis and a drug for allergies.
But the poor results may have something to do with the drugs the team studied. Biopharma analyst Eric Snyder with Meta Partners says people who have arthritis or allergies have a slew of drugs to choose from, so the ads can end up sounding like white noise.
When it's just a competitive class and it's essentially like, you know, brands of cereal barking at each other, nothing really sticks.
Snyder says direct-to-consumer drug advertising does work for new drug therapies. But the Harvard researchers say it's only a temporary sales uptick. And who doesn't laugh when it comes time for the ad to list the drug's side effects? Again, here's study author Stephen Sumire.
I think there are a lot of smart consumers out there, and they see these ads are silly, and they see the required side effects, some of which are actually terrible.
The study in the British Medical Journal comes at a time when the U.S. Senate may consider a bill that would limit some pharmaceutical ads. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Coming up, women weave silk and build confidence in Cambodia.
If we can help women to have her own income, just automatically her value will improve in the family, in the society.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street took a much-needed day off today after a wicked summer, and so we turn to Europe, where shares ended the day lower. In London, the FTSE lost 0.6%. In France, the CAC 40 dropped 0.2%. And Germany's DAX was basically flat, off less than 0.1%. But the country's Commerzbank lost 10% of its share value as investors decided it had paid too much to acquire Dresdner from Allianz. The $14.5 billion deal was announced over the weekend. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity. Online at us.areva.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation. Online at kauffman.org. song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez makes his first state visit to South Africa. Trade and the economy are at the top of the agenda. The defense ministers of the Americas convene in Alberta. More than 500 military personnel from 34 countries will attend. And models strut their stuff down Tokyo catwalks as Japan's Fashion Week continues. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Labor Day when many Americans get to tend barbecues instead of tending paperwork at the office. Or, as the Department of Labor defines it, it is a day to recognize the contributions workers have made to the strength, prosperity, and well-being of our country. Well, today our lives and our well-being are linked with people working all over the world, and that global economy is the backdrop for our series called Working, where we delve into the life of a single worker doing a job, trying to get by. Today we bring you four of the people we've profiled in the last year and a half. Their work has touched our lives if we've bought a leather jacket, or nibbled at a bar of fine chocolate, or if we bought something made in China. That's where we head first, to Beijing. Producer Sandy Tolan met Mr. Wong there. He's a bicycle delivery man for an express mail service.
I'm a postman for EMS, Chinese Express Mail.
Every Monday through Friday, Lao Wong gets on his bicycle and rides into the wall of sound known as modern Beijing.
Seven, eight, nine.
It's mid-afternoon now, and Mr. Wong is sifting through a leaning tower of packages bound from Beijing to more than 100 countries.
USA, Hong Kong, France.
Now, does Mr. Wong ever wonder what's in these packages, where they're going, why, and what's the big rush?
No, I never think about that.
Mr. Wong shifts into gear now, easing his green express mail van into the flotsam of Beijing traffic, a speck in a vast river of commerce.
Just look at the cars on the roads of Beijing. But everybody's eager to come to live in Beijing.
The fact is, he's like a lot of us, dare I say hundreds of millions of us around the world. Mr. Wong works to live. He doesn't want to know more about the quarter million or more packages he's picked up in the last dozen years, those urgent documents, factory samples, or packages that must be there the next day. For Mr. Wong, it's just a job.
I just want to make some money.
And if he's thinking not so much about the destination of the packages, he is thinking how far they might take his young daughter.
Bye-bye. All done for today. I'm leaving. See you next Monday. Bye-bye.
And now, the van parked at the post office, Mr. Wong pedals back in time with one little stop along the way.
I like KFC better, Chinese food.
And that is Wong Zheng, Mr. Wong's only child, the driving force of his labors. Shy and round-faced, Wong Zheng is 12. She's in pigtails and pink sneakers, waiting in line at the KFC to order her nuggets. Mr. Wong stands beside her, beaming as she tries out her English. She prefers KFC over Chinese food, though she says it's not her favorite.
I like McDonald's better.
Every time Mr. Wong takes Wong Zheng here, on his salary of $55 a week, it's going to cost him half a day's pay. And that's just for the chicken. Wong Zheng's tastes run to shiny things, like CDs of Chinese pop stars. things her dad never could have imagined back in the days of the Cultural Revolution. The family sleeps in her modern apartment across town, so Wang Zheng can have her own room, chat with her friends online, and get a competitive edge in her studies. Nowadays, Mr. Wang says, it's all about getting ahead. Why else would he spend so much time hauling packages through traffic? Next morning, Mr. Wang is back at the pigeon coop, ready for another day in the express mail van. He's already fed his birds and released them. Now, he's calling them home.
Mr. Wang's job is just that to him, a job. In our next profile, we meet a woman whose work is her calling, and perhaps our fantasy. Chloe Dutre-Roussel is a chocolate taster. Job requirements? An incredible sense of smell and brutal honesty. She travels all over the world to taste and give advice about chocolate. John Miller caught up with her in Ecuador.
When I do chocolate tasting, I usually prepare a glass of warm water because the cocoa butter sticks to the mouth and the warm water will dissolve the cocoa butter and really clean much better the palate. So now I'm going to taste another chocolate. I know the chocolate. It's a good friend. So it's little ovals that are all scratching between themselves, so they don't look very sexy. I'm very happy nobody's tempted and only me. When I look at it closely, I can see in the cut that there is no bubbles or particles, so you can already see it with your own eyes that it has been properly tempered. Now I'm going to approach it from my ear. And this is a quite sharp snap, so it's again a proof that it has been properly tempered. And now I'm going to smell. It has some fruit notes. It's always hard for people to understand that you can feel fruits in a chocolate. Well, when you are exploring the taste, the aromas of fine chocolate, you need to explore what we call the aromatic families, floral, fruit, vegetal. It's exactly the same families that are analyzed in the world of perfume, tea, coffee, olive oil. So we all use the same vocabulary. So now I'm going to taste. After 10 seconds of cutting the chocolate into small pieces, you just stop any movement with the mouth, close your eyes, and concentrate. Don't swallow. It should melt in such a harmony with the body that you will not even notice it is melting. It's not something that you will be conscious of. The first thing you feel is not the aromas, but more an acidity. You have like sparkles on the side of the tongue. And once the acidity tempers, appear some red fruit notes. The red fruit notes are very powerful and at the same time elegant and light, and they last very long. It's a good sign for a chocolate. So this chocolate is complex, intense, elegant, with no aggressivity but a very strong personality. The chocolate we just had is the Mangiare from Varona. Varona has another chocolate called Guanaja. And I like to describe the difference between Mangiare and Guanaja. Like if you close your eyes and you imagine a handsome man dressed up with a suit. I'm a woman, so I always refer to a man. In the case of the Guanaja, it would be a kind of cheruti suit, black with white lines, very elegant. And the Mangiare would be the same handsome man, but with a purple suit from Kenzo and a pink tie. Also very handsome, very elegant, but a bit eccentric. People tell me often that I have the best job in the world because I travel so much and I eat chocolate for free. Well, first, there is not a free lunch, I think you say in English, because the time I spend around chocolate is a time I don't spend learning music, drinking with friends. It would be much more simple for me to just go and buy chocolate and enjoy life.
Chloe works at the highest levels of the chocolate industry. Our next profile takes us to Pakistan to meet a teenager who toils at the lowest end of another industry. 17-year-old Momin works at a tannery in Karachi, Pakistan. He's been on the job since he left his village at the age of 13. Greg Warner has his story.
What's that sound? That
Timing.
Timing? It's time to get back to work.
Moman stands next to a pile of nearly finished leather. He picks up each piece and lays it flat on a belt. The skins pass under a machine that sprays them with dye. When he works his way through that pile, he gets more skins.
That's the whole work.
That's the whole work.
It's the job he's done 6 days a week for 4 years. His boss, Shabir, says he doesn't have much else to look forward to.
People get old over here in these factories only, and they don't really change or they don't really become anything better.
How long many years do they have usually?
Until he's healthy.
Until he's healthy, Shabir says. About 22 years, on average. Factory chemicals are toxic. Asthma is common, especially in workers that started young, like Momin. So is cancer. And unlike Shabir, his manager, Momin can't go to the window for fresh air when he feels queasy. He may never have that sort of privilege. Karachi's leather industry isn't booming the way it was a decade ago. It's harder for new arrivals to get ahead, with so many willing to replace them. At lunchtime, I follow Momin back to the room he rents with his older brother, his uncles and cousins. They sit on the floor, sharing a bowl of lentils with flatbread. I ask him about his work.
Here you are, you speak three languages, you're a bright guy. Is this very boring work for you?
There's a discussion, and then my translator shrugs his shoulders.
The meaning of boredom, he doesn't get it.
Momin doesn't know the word for boredom. It's just not something he thinks about.
Your life seems so hard, and yet when you talk, you're able to smile. Why is that?
Most of the people are better off than me, so I usually don't want to smile, but that's all I can do. I can just smile, and I have this smile that is mine.
The next day is Sunday, Momin's day off. Every few Sundays, Momin will call his father back in the village. He uses their group cell phone. They speak in Pashto.
Hello, assalamu alaikum.
How are you? Momin asks his dad. Fine, how are you? It's not much, but Momin's grinning. And then his father makes a request. I'm getting old, his father says. I want to go on the Hajj. The Hajj is the pilgrimage to Saudi Arabia that all Muslims are commanded to do. Momin's smile fades. The Hajj would cost about $3,000. Momin only saves about $60 a month. And that all goes toward family debts. Momin himself doesn't even own a toothbrush. He hasn't visited home in almost 2 years.
How will I go home if I have to keep paying somebody? And that's what I usually do, end up doing. I keep paying people the money that somebody from my family owes.
That was Greg Warner with a story of 17-year-old Momin, adding some perspective to our own complaints about our work lives. Let's move on to a story about working and redemption. Chanta Nguyen survived the killing fields in Cambodia. Today, she's a CEO. Her company hand-produces silk scarves for the global market, working with a non-governmental organization. Rachel Louise Snyder produced this profile.
How long does it take to make one average size scarf?
So first we spend 1 hour to wash the raw silk and 1 or 2 days to set up the warp. It's just half of it. They need another 7 days to finish. For that process, they spend another 5 days.
So how many, I've lost track. How many days are we up to?
11 to 12 days.
For a scarf?
No, to start to weave the scarf.
The grand total? 15 days. Unless...
You see the pattern, the flower pattern. That's another 9 days. But if they make a mistake, then they spend another week to remove everything.
This is obsessive compulsive work. 60 full-time women earn $50 to $100 a month, where the country average is 25. But for the women who work here, it's not just about money. It's about status and education.
If we can help women to have her own income, just automatically she... her value will improve in the family, in the society.
Her life and her business evolved out of tragedy. During the 1970s, the Khmer Rouge forced the population into farm labor in the countryside. They abolished money and personal freedom. Families were torn apart.
one of my brothers, he was taken away, and we don't know if he's still alive or he died. We just lost him.
This disastrous social experiment killed an estimated 1.5 million people. Chantal and her mother fled to Vietnam, where they spent 10 years. She spent 9 more years in a refugee camp on the Thai border. There, she got an education, first in English, then in women's empowerment, while working for Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders. She met her husband Chan in the camp, and in 1993, they returned to Cambodia. For the first 10 years of their marriage, Chan made the decisions, and she stayed quietly at home. But after a while, Shanta felt like she couldn't breathe. At first, he fought her change.
We compare ASEAN women with moonlight in the family. I mean, soft, cool, quiet. So I live 10 years, my first 10 years of marriage like that. I couldn't speak loudly and I couldn't laugh loudly. But after 10 years, I feel it's not me at all. So I start to fight with my husband. I want to be myself. Why I can't laugh? Why I can't speak loudly? So I told him, I am sunlight, not moonlight.
To find out more about Shanta, as well as Moman, Chloe, and Mr. Wong, head to our website, marketplace.org, and click on Working. You'll also find the stories of more than a dozen other workers from around the world, from Nigeria and Lebanon to Belize and the border between Kosovo and Albania. Working is a co-production of Homelands Productions, with major funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the International Labor Organization. The theme music was composed by Robbie Aceto.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, a Wagnerian lesson in the importance of corporate succession plans. And I mean Wagnerian. Two descendants of the composer Richard Wagner have won a family power struggle worthy of one of their great-granddad's epic stage works. 89-year-old Wolfgang Wagner, Richard's grandson, stepped down last month after 57 years at the festival's helm. But his daughter and her half-sister fought for months with a cousin over who would succeed him. Today, the battle was put to a vote, and the cycle ended. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the U.S. markets were closed for Labor Day. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, cutting costs by cutting school.
I wish I could say that it's very unusual for school districts to have problems with budgets, but it isn't. It's always been a struggle and always will be.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.